Well, I introduced Beverly to you. Beverly is the new account administrator. Beverly's been with us for about 6 years, mm-hmm. something like that. And you want to kind of brag about yourself a little
bit? Yeah, sure. Yeah, I've been in trust services for about 30 years. I worked for U.S. Bank and for a U.S. trust company before coming to West Coast. Right now, my duties are primarily with pension and profit sharing type plans. And I also work with investment management and custody accounts.
Thanks. I've just been in Arizona. I guess I'm still on a vacation. Sorry
to call you back.
No,
that was a pretty quick trip for me.
I know. I just got up yesterday. Thanks for the call, Linda.
So I know that especially Linda will love working with Beverly. Beverly handles my most sensitive accounts for me and tells me where I've screwed up. And so,
does she tell you where you've succeeded?
She promises she will. So let me take just a few minutes to bring you up to date on the bank's merger. West Coast Bank and Columbia Bank of Tacoma are going to merge. They've announced a merger. It will take, I think the merger was announced in early October. The expectation is that the legal work will get completed in something like 3 to 6 months. The resulting bank will be have a little over $7 billion in assets. There'll be, we currently have a total of 170 branches, and there are only 10 overlaps. And so from a branch staff perspective, it'll be a pretty friendly transition. Those overlaps are primarily on the south side of Portland and in the valley, and I think there's one in Vancouver. But there are places where we're literally across the street from each other, you know, so there'll have to be some decisions made there. The bank will have a much larger footprint in Oregon and Washington. Along the I-5 corridor, we'll go from Tacoma to Eugene. And then on the coast, we'll go from Astoria to Walport. Bend, the Columbia Valley, primarily around the Dalles in that neighborhood, Yakima Valley, Walla Walla, Colfax, and Spokane. Okay. So we'll be able to travel to all the greatest land locations. The trust company is going to be treated a little bit differently than the bank. The bank is going to create an Oregon and Southwest Washington region, and that will be headed up by Hadley Robbins, who is now our senior credit officer. I don't know if you've bumped into Hadley along the way, but you'll get a chance to meet him. He's a great guy. He's a fisherman. He's on the board of the Freshwater Trust, and so he will be reporting directly to Melanie Dressler, who is the CEO of Columbia. Bob Snowbus is going to retire. And Anders Gilfit, who's the CFO of West Coast Bank, will retire. But we'll have that Oregon Southwest Washington region that will be operated as a more of a distinct entity than Washington. If you look at the footprint, the merger makes a lot of sense because they are primarily a Washington bank with a little bit of business in Oregon, and we're primarily an Oregon bank with a little bit of business in Washington. So it's gonna be a good situation for bank customers. The trust department at Columbia Bank is the department of a failed bank that they acquired from the FDIC several years ago. It was a bank on Bainbridge Island, American Marine. And they had a fairly small trust operation with only about four people. And so the decision that's been made there is that the management team of West Coast Trust will take responsibility for the new trust operation. And we'll have about $750 million in assets on opening day. The investment team will grow by one. They've got a young fellow up there that will become part of my team. And we're just beginning to get all those things straightened out. We're going to have about 6 months of evaluating which accounting system we want to use, you know, merging policy manuals, procedure manuals, and so. The meetings have started, and you know, it's just what you get if you go into banking. And I've now been a banker for 38 years, and every bank that I've ever worked for now has either merged or been sold away.
Do you see any relationship between you working with them?
I'm almost positive there's no connection.
I just wanted to get that clear.
But the question has been asked. There is a golf tournament that goes off in Corvallis every year with a bunch of old retired geezer bankers, and it's called the Lost Logo Golf Tournament. What you have to do is you have to wear a hat with a logo of a bank that no longer exists.
I still have a Bank of Newport hat.
I think I do too.
Yeah.
And a frisbee. Yeah, I'm think of it.
Oh, I've got First Interstate golf balls.
No, I've First National. That's right. Lincoln Bank.
When is the merger going to take effect?
That's a little hazy. There's a lot of work that has to occur, but somewhere I would estimate the legal aspects of the transaction will be consummated probably in the second quarter, I would guess.
Okay.
And then over the remainder of the year, you'll see branding begin to change. There are a lot of decisions that have yet to be made on that. There's one sort of plan that is potentially on the drawing board that West Coast may operate as a wholly owned subsidiary for a while and allow them to do that at their leisure. I don't give that a lot of credence, although it is an easy way to do it. You know, and then there's another question that comes up about how to handle us, you know, because it has so many moving parts that you just can't imagine. And the government is involved because you even get down to a question of who's going to examine you, you know, and so the Oregon regulators love us in the trust area because we're so easy to examine. We're very clean, and we don't have any warts, and so they really like us. And they don't want us to go away, but they suspect that if we become the Department of a Washington bank, you know, then Washington examines us, you know, and then the Federal Reserve examines us on the federal side now. And if we become a department of that bank, then the FDIC examines us. So it's a question of which blue suits are in your conference room at any given time. So at any rate, that's what we know now, and we're just in the middle of making all of those decisions, and it'll probably be the major staffing changes will occur in the back office. As they consolidate all their operating systems. And as far as West Coast Bank goes, most of that is in Wilsonville and Salem. So I don't think you would expect to see different faces out here, because we don't have any operations functions here to speak of. So people friendly, no houses getting sold, hopefully. People moving around. So, I've got the third quarter report, and I've also got an October 31st update for you.
Tim, can we take care of this bit of business?
Sure.
Since it'll be really quick? We need to, since we have a quorum, thanks guys, we need to vote on adding a person to the signature, giving signature authority to these accounts. Resolved that any person designated below shall be authorized for the account of City of Newport with West Coast Trust Company, which we'll see if that's still the name, to execute on behalf of the retirement plans, blah, 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 blah. Tim is on here, and he would really like another person, and he suggested Mike Schultz.
Sounds good.
Fine. You okay with that?
Second.
Me too.
I'm okay.
Who made the motion?
I move that we accept the wonderful, illustrious Mike Schultz.
Okay.
Aye. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. You can sign that, Michael.
He's got work already, huh?
Yeah.
So you want me to print my name and fill all that out?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, if you would, please.
Legal name?
How are you going to sign it?
How you sign it.
I'm just curious, as far as the trust office, is there going to be any change in physical location?
No.
Okay, everything stays the same now.
Everything's the same. We're going to we'll have a Tacoma office. And that is just as you come into downtown Tacoma, Columbia Bank Tower is there, and that's where the trust department is. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I've got a third quarter full report and an October 31st update. The third quarter was a fairly, I wouldn't call it a strong quarter economically, but the market did pretty well. There were issues with Europe in the third quarter, but those subsided, and we had a fairly strong September. On October 1st, the world apparently woke up to the fact that this cliff was coming, and we've had quite a bit of volatility, and the volatility in the market has increased, and the market will go up or down based on what somebody says coming out of the meeting, and you know, we're going to continue to have that. Fundamentally, the economy is still fragile, but showing signs of life. The monetary policy is still extremely accommodative. Balance sheets are very strong. But if you look at certain key components of the economy, they're holding up very well. Housing, the home builder stocks have now just about doubled coming off of 2009. Now, of course, they were down by 80% going into 2009, but they have held up very well. There are some other important economic indicators that are pointing in the right direction. Copper prices are holding up very, very strong. The reason that's important is that everywhere you look, in bulk, in all of your handhelds, all of your phones, and all the walls, there's copper. And when demand for copper goes up, that tells you that the economy is feeling more optimistic than if the price of copper is going down. Manufacturing and service indices are holding up relatively well. Now, the number to watch there, those are called the ISM indexes. That's the Institute of Supply Managers, and they do an index for manufacturing and one for service. A number below 50 indicates contraction. A number above 50 is positive. And we've been slightly below 50, but we've ticked up to where we're at 50 and change. And so that's starting to move in the right direction. Consumers are continuing to deleverage, and companies are reluctant to spend money. So you have sort of a dichotomy. in some of the fundamental numbers versus how people are making personal financial decisions and business decisions, and that all revolves around the fiscal cliff. I'm getting tired of calling it the fiscal cliff, but it's all...
You could always call it Armageddon.
It's all revolving around what's going to happen on December 31st. You are beginning to see some companies that are paying very large year-end dividends. Costco is going to pay a $7 dividend before the end of the year in hopes of, because they feel fairly certain that the tax on dividends is going to go up, so they want to get it off the balance sheet, get it into the hands of shareholders now. There are people who are making what I consider to be ridiculous financial decisions, selling all of their stock this year, thinking that capital gains rates are going to go up. Well, were you going to sell your stock next year? And they said, no, won't. but you have things like that that are going on, and that's causing the stock market to jump around a little bit. I don't personally think that we're going to get a decision, a resolution, by the end of the year. What we may get is an agreement to leave the Bush tax cuts in place for 250 and under. You had yesterday one of the leading, very conservative Republicans who said, let's go ahead and do that because there's no sense in punishing middle-class America because we just can't agree on wealthy people. And so there may be some consensus around extending the tax cuts there, but I don't think there's going to be any kind of agreement on spending. There's not going to be any kind of agreement on the broader tax situation until well into 2013, if then. That is important because it's going to have an impact on the way the ratings agencies view our balance sheet. And it will not be favorable because something has to happen on entitlements for us to preserve what is now our lower credit rating. So that's gonna be at the center of the debate, and you've seen it so dominates the investment landscape. You know, Argentina is about to default on its debt, and nobody cares. Greece is still a total mess, and nobody cares. Europe is in a recession, and nobody cares. It's all about December 31st. And that's why yesterday, for instance, the president sounded combative, Senator Reid made some combative statements, and the S&P was down 10. The president came out and said, well, maybe we can get something done. We go up 20 points and close up 10 for the day. And so you're going to have these movements in the market that have no relationship to fundamentals. It will turn on a dime. And it might turn up, it might turn down. All of that having been said, I have been Dr. Doom in this meeting for years.
I'm waiting for this.
I think that if we get past that with any kind of reasonable certainty, if you look at the underlying strength in the economy, we've cut away all the fat, we've streamlined, and we have a huge amount of pent-up demand. People have held off on equipment decisions. Mike can tell you what's the average age of the American car today. I think that if we get at least some sort of resolution on the income tax issue and have at least a roadmap toward some kind of spending reform, especially on entitlements, that we could easily have a 10 to 15% year up in the market next year.
Can I ask a question? So in your view, it's not, the swings really isn't dependent on what decision is made. It seems the lack of a decision is driving things more than whatever the decision is that's going to be made one way or another.
Exactly. I wrote a piece in my blog that goes internally a couple of weeks ago, comparing this to the period around the first Iraq War. And if you recall, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, there were it was just extremely volatile because you had the potential for nuclear war in the region where we got all of our oil. And the S&P sold off 20% in 2 months on that uncertainty. The American economy didn't change. We were still fundamentally the same. And the market rebounded, but it didn't rebound after the war was over. It rebounded after we invaded. And, you know, the question became, what are we going to do? Well, here's what we're going to do. And everybody said, okay, then.
I'll buy some more stock.
I'll buy some stock. And we rebounded. We went up 20% from there. In fact, we were up further from there. So it is purely about uncertainty.
So what you're saying is the market, in your experience, isn't based on fundamentals. It's based on psychology and what people think or perceive rather than what's actually happening.
There is a strong behavioral component to the performance of the stock market. There is a whole school of thought called behavioral finance.
There's also rationality about people that invest in it a lot, too. I mean, but you can't predict all of this.
Keynes famously once said that the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent.
Juries are somewhat that way.
So we've had a pretty strong 12 months coming into the end of the third quarter. The fourth quarter, I think, is going to be choppy. The S&P was up about 15% through the end of the third quarter. I expect that we're going to finish the year more likely up single digits, so I think we're going to be down 4 or 5% from where we are now, because the uncertainty is not going to drive the market up. The uncertainty will drive the market down. And now, if there is no resolution, and if people just for some reason decide to draw a line in the sand, we could easily have a very nasty sell-off. It could get very bad, but I really don't think that that's the most probable case. That being said, we have decided that the greater risk is to the downside, and we're extremely conservative in the portfolio now, and we're more conservative than we were at the last meeting. We're going to be ready as the month of December progresses. If we get to a resolution, we're going to move back up to probably a neutral stance, and because I think there's going to be a good market next year that we're going to participate in.
So what does that actually mean when you say you've been more conservative?
We've got cash in the portfolio right now.
Okay.
We've got about 8% cash.
And okay. So you've been selling it.
We raised some cash in the 1st of October.
Okay.
Yeah. And we raised that at about 1450 on the S&P. And I think we're...
So you sold high?
Well, we sold less, you know. We didn't sell at the top by any means, and we don't try to do that.
Right.
But we decided in early October that the greater risk was to the downside, and we wanted to have a little less exposure to the stock market. And it has sold off since we did that. So, I've got the consolidated report here on the DB plan. And I'm now at page 2 of 17, and at the bottom there, the balance of the entire plan at the end of the quarter was $4,080,940. For the quarter, we were up $138,958, which was 3.5% on the portfolio. Now I'm going to turn to page 9 of 17, which has the pie chart. And we'll talk about the assets there.
So that's that 0.9% cash.
That was actual cash that came into the account on the end of the quarter.
Are those city payments, or
I'm not sure what it would have been, but it was And this is as of September 30th.
As of September 30th.
Ah. That's right, until October. Thanks, Mike.
It was $655. It was probably an interest payment on something. But that gets swept every night, and it goes into the money market account, and which is an interest-bearing account. And you see there that at the end of the quarter, we have a total of 8.5% in there. Now, that is in the... that's a portion that's being held for making payments, and it's in the short term.
So that's in line with our original plan.
Yes. Now, the corporate bonds, I think, actually, let me go back to the individual accounts, because it's going to make a little more sense. If we turn past tab one, what we have there is the money market account. And it, at the end of the quarter, had $120,000 in it. And that's what we used to pay disbursements, distributions out to participants and whatnot. And tab two is the capital growth account. And, of course, this is the one that has the bulk of the investments in it. So a very small amount of cash at the end of the quarter, 0.6%. In the bond component, 15.8% of the account is in bonds. And in that one, we did 2.6% for the quarter, and the benchmark did 1.59%. Well, the reason that we're ahead of the benchmark there is, as you know, we've had no exposure to treasuries. So treasuries did not do as well during the third quarter because the market was up, people were selling treasuries. We had no exposure to treasuries, and so we did better than the benchmark. In the month of August, we, if you recall from the last meeting, we got out of the high-yield sector. And we have held that in short-term bonds in the interim, and that will be reinvested into the broader portfolio during the month of December. And that is the balance fund there. It's miscategorized, I just noticed, by the system, but that's your short-term bonds. And that did 44 basis points for the quarter. The growth fund, we had a up market, so the growth fund did pretty well. It did 697, and the S&P did 635 for the quarter. The value fund trailed. The market's up, so the value side of the spectrum doesn't do quite as well. It did 555, and our mid-cap fund did 394. You see here the utilities category on the next page, on page 3 of 6, where we had 9.5%. We may have discussed this during the last meeting, I don't recall, but utilities have been a very popular asset class to hold during the last several years because they pay a high dividend and they are less volatile than the rest of the market. It has become so popular a trade that the utility sector is actually now overvalued. And when we decided to raise cash during the early 2 weeks of October, that's where we raised that cash from. We liquidated the utilities position, and we're going to reinvest that in the broader portfolio when we get to some resolution during the month of December.
So we're no longer holding anything in utilities?
No, we're not. We don't have any utilities. Okay. That's in the money market now.
So would that change your proposed coming in? Would be more so in the materials and industrial sectors and those types?
Well, we're going to invest across in the core managers and put it across all sectors, because we believe that there's a good chance that the economy will improve next year, and we want to have broad exposure to the whole economy rather than one specific, very conservative sector. And again, I do think that we're going to have a good year in the economy next year.
I'm going to hold you to that, Trav.
I know you do. Rebecca's in charge of the corporate memory. I have a pretty high level of confidence about next year. I think this is going to be a good year if Congress will get out of the way.
Yeah.
Or we just quit listening to them.
Yeah. Well, I did that a long time ago. We had a very good quarter in the utilities holding. It did 11%. And that's going to continue to be a core holding. I think the argument for energy is very important. If you believe that we're in a long-term recovery, it makes sense that energy will become more scarce. There will be more demand for energy, and we think especially so in the emerging world.
Well, then we're producing more.
I'm sorry?
The U.S. is producing more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the difference between utilities and energy types of stocks?
Well, utilities would be the electricity companies, gas companies, just the regional utilities, Commonwealth Edison,
Distributors.
Distributors, yeah.
Not producers. In the energy sector?
Energy sector is Exxon. The oil companies are in there. The coal companies are in there. The wind companies are in there. The solar companies are in there. I think that's going to be an important part of the global economy in the coming years. Staples, we continue to hold because they are unlike utilities. Although it's a defensive position, it's not overvalued. But I think as we get to a recovery, the staples position will be on the table. And then, of course, the emerging equities did 5.8. So all in, we did 4.33 for the quarter. And turning the page over a broader period for the 12 months, and I'm looking now on page 5, for the 12 months ending September 30th, the portfolio did 21.43%, and the 80-20 index did 24. We're trailing there primarily because we're underweight the index. I would imagine that when we look at this in the first quarter, we're going to be a little closer to the index, but we've intentionally underweighted relative to the index. 8.96 over the last 3 years, and then of course over the last 5 years reflects the crash. In the month of October, and now I'm turning to this spreadsheet at the end, after page 6, portfolio now holds the short-term component. Again, is where the cash is. The 8.6% is in that short-term bond fund. In the taxable bonds, 16% of the portfolio is there. It did 295. You can see the in the month of October, the S&P was off a little bit, 3.5%. The month of November, it's probably flat to slightly negative. And international did 5.23. So for year to date, and that's fiscal year to date since July 1st, it's about flat for the month of October and 3.23 year to date. The next tab is the benchmark account. And I want to just raise an issue for discussion with you here. You know, the original idea that we had was to have laddered treasuries, and then interest rates collapsed. It looks like interest rates are going to be at zero or barely above zero for the next 2 years. If we were to move this into just a broad fixed income portfolio that had general exposure to the broad bond market, we could raise the current income on this to about 3.25%, 3.5%. And I think you can do that with very little credit risk. If you recall, the rationale for this account is you want very low volatility for a portion of the portfolio that covers the next 4 or 5 years of distributions. Mm-hmm. I think that we can probably safely move that into the broader market, broader bond market, and get your current income up on it, because rates are not going to go up anytime soon.
No. They can't go below zero, can they?
Yes, they can.
Really?
The Bank of England is actually considering negative interest rates.
So they're paying people to borrow money.
Yeah.
So even if the economy takes off next year, the Treasury's not going to move the needle?
The Treasury well might go up a little bit, but the Fed is going to remain extremely accommodative. And the short to intermediate end of the curve is going to be anchored to Fed policy. The longer end of the Treasury curve could very well go up. But I don't think that's going to happen in a meaningful way. Now, one thing that could happen is that if Congress gets in the way, and there is absolutely no decision, interest rates could conceivably go up just because of our credit rating. Now, if you recall, we had exactly the opposite happen in the summer of 2011. Our credit rating got lowered and interest rates went down because the perception was that everything else was so bad that even at a lower rating, treasuries were still the place to be. Now, the broader bond market will have about 30% exposure to treasuries, and the rest of it is corporate and mortgage debt.
So to make that movement, what do you need from us?
Well, I'd like to hear from Linda, though, Rebecca, about potential payouts.
Right.
Yeah. Right now I have one retiree that you don't have paperwork. I'm still waiting for the paperwork to come in from the actuary. That's the only one that I know.
Has that person decided how they want to take the money?
They have not. I have a talking with them. They're leaning toward taking the annuity right at this moment.
Uh-huh. And the liability for that is? I mean, how much?
This one's, around $150,000.
Well, you certainly don't have to do it today. I'd just like to raise that as a discussion point. I think we've probably got 2 more years of accommodative policy. The one thing that could happen that might change that is that Chairman Bernanke's term expires January 1st, 2014. I think that the President will probably appoint somebody who has similar views on monetary policy. And if I were to bet today, it would probably be Janet Yellen, who is the head of the San Francisco Fed. And she speaks with exactly the same voice as Ben Bernanke. You know, when Ben Bernanke wants to speak unofficially, he rolls her out. While I don't think that there will be substantive changes in monetary policy, it could happen. You know, she could certainly begin to steer things in a more restrictive way because there is a very strong body of opposition on the Fed to the accommodative policy that we have now, and it could very well be that that might change. So let me just raise that now, and we can talk about it at the January meeting, if you will, and see where we stand. But if nothing changes, I don't see why we shouldn't maybe get a little broader exposure and and raise the return on this above where it is now.
That would at least double the return, it looks like.
It would.
Your question back on page 5, where you have the annualized rate of returns over the periods. For the last few years, you're about 8.96%. Linda, that's a little bit higher. Our actual, in the actual aerial report, the rate of return actually is a little more conservative, isn't it? So we're actually are performing more than what we actually are basing a lot of our assumptions on when the report comes out each year.
Well, that report's always 4 months behind.
No, but I'm saying it's always been a constant around 6%. I mean, they keep it pretty constant. I don't think they kind of base it on what they're getting here in the report. So what I'm saying is it looks like what we're seeing as a performance is a little bit higher on a rate of return than what the actuary uses when they come up with their annual report, or is that
they
is there a
actually
difference? They use Rick's stuff?
Rick's numbers.
Okay.
Their numbers.
Okay.
Well, all
I just want clarity on that, because that report is something that I think people look at.
That's just a portion of the fund. I want to caution you on that. The fund as a whole, the DB plan as a whole, did 1543 last year and 663 over the last 3 years.
663, okay. Right.
And I think, so let me just kind of do a little sidebar on expectations. We have another large defined benefit plan that's in a funding, has a funding problem right now. And their actuary sent them a report that estimated a 9.3% return. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think just, I don't know what the actuary used.
He uses your returns, okay. I know.
And the report should be coming out fairly soon for the last
year. So you haven't seen it yet?
No.
So
very frustrated.
In the past, it's been November, December. We usually been getting it. It goes a little bit behind the audit. The audit, you know, the audit's end of the year, and we always like to have the actuarial report kind of the same time frame. So, I remember seeing a 6% rate of return as a pretty constant
November.
Throughout those reports over the years. Yeah. I'm just curious what your take is.
Well,
on that.
I put together a report for these folks recently to try to put expectations in perspective. If you look over the last 60 years, the S&P 500 has averaged an annual return of 11% in combined price appreciation and dividends. But that 11% is a 60-year average over a very, very long time horizon. If you break that down to the annual return in each calendar decade, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, in the 50s, the S&P had a return in the high teens. In the 60s, it had a slightly lower return. In the 70s, it had a return of only about 3%. In the 80s, it had a return around 15%. In the 90s, it was about 15%. In the last decade, it was negative. And so what I would encourage you to think about in terms of long-term expectations is, over 40 or 50 years, 11% is clearly something that will probably happen. Over the next several years, because of the depth of the crash that we had and the fact that it was credit-related, and the credit is going to be very tight coming out of it. It's going to be very long. It's going to be very slow. It's going to be very shallow. But I think the 10-year return of the market is probably going to be something more like 5%. So we're above what I believe is a reasonable expectation, but we're going to be below for some time now, I think, what is the long-term historical average. So I guess one way to look at it optimistically is that better times are coming, but I don't think they're here yet. So while I think we're going to have a good year next year, I think that's going to be offset with more volatility as Europe and the other things sort themselves out.
Okay.
I think next year, the reason I'm optimistic about next year is that there's so much pent-up demand, and we've gone for so long without significant capital spending. Productivity numbers are extremely high, which means that companies just can't produce any more without hiring somebody else, or without making some form of investment. So, I think in terms of 5%
okay.
over the short term, and over the period of a lifetime, 11%.
If I only got 6 years.
And that 5% isn't that far up from what I've seen in the prior actuary reports, which is hovering between 5 and 6% over the past decade that I've been looking at. So.
Well, and just look at the, you know, you look at the S&P.
Right.
Yeah. So. Now, so that's the DB plan. Now we have the contribution portion of the plan, a little simpler, just in one pool. And then on pages 2 and 3, at the end of the quarter, it was at $3.8 million. We were up $137,000 for the quarter. We have this in a 60% equity, 40% fixed income allocation, and the bonds did 2.67% for the quarter. The aggregate bond index did 159. You see, we have no exposure to high yield. In August, we got out of high yield again there because we were concerned about the spread of high yield securities to treasuries. We might have been a month or two early on that. High yield improved a little further, but it has since begun to sell off on uncertainty. So we've made the right move ultimately. We put that money into the what is shown there as a balance fund, but that's the short-term bond fund, and that's going to go into the broader portfolio as we get to the end of the year. We have the large growth, large value, and mid-cap, same funds that we have in the other account. We have also the utilities position that we have since sold. The energy sector at 1115, and staples and emerging, and for a total for the quarter of 375. And turning the page, on page 5 of 6, for the year ending September 30th, the portfolio was up 17.8%, and for the 3 years, 846 and 234 over the last 5 years. Points up, I think, is a good opportunity to point up the importance of a balanced fund. Your portfolio is up 234 for that period, and for the 5 year period annually. For that same period of time, the S&P 500 is up 1%. So the bond position did its job for you during that period. Now I'm going to turn the page again to the October numbers. And there you see the bonds. And this is again year to date, and that is from June 30th through October 31st. And you can see that we had a little bit of a sell off for that year to date period, up 318, where at the end of September 30th we were up 375, so we had about a 60 basis point decline during the month of October. We're going to make a couple of moves in the portfolio when we rebalance, probably around December the 20th, somewhere in there. We're going to do a major rebalance for all of our accounts. Some of that will be driven by income tax on our taxable accounts. But there's also, we want to just wait and see how the fiscal issue resolves itself before we make any major moves in the portfolios. At that time, we will take the money that's in the short-term assets, and that's going to, assuming we have resolution, that will go toward broader exposure to the broad stock market. We're going to also change the manager for the emerging markets fund. Now we own the index, and so it's an unmanaged portfolio. The problem is that the Vanguard is changing its index. And the Vanguard got into a pricing issue with the with Morgan Stanley, who is the proprietor of the index that most people follow on that. And they couldn't agree on pricing, and so they moved all of their index funds to the FTSE, which is the FTSE, which is the English stock exchange. Well, they manufacture their own indices, and they cut a deal with Vanguard. The problem with the FTSE index is that it doesn't include South Korea as an emerging. They consider South Korea to be a developed nation. And that's about 14% of the old index. And so that's 14% that's going primarily to China in the new index. And we do not want that much exposure to China. So we're going to move to an artisan product that uses fundamental bottom-up stock analysis there instead of index exposure, just because we don't believe the numbers that come out of China.
So you think that there's going to be that the signals of some upheaval in the Chinese markets?
They've not done very well. China, the Chinese market is down around 2008 levels right now. There's a lot of there's a lot of commotion over there, and you know their numbers are what they want them to be, so.
Is that labor unrest partially for China? I'm hearing things about people getting kind of fed up with low wages, and
they're on the way to becoming a consumer economy. And
tough to turn back from that.
It's tough to turn back.
Yeah. And politically, they're not there yet.
You know, they've all got a new Buick. But they can't put gas in it.
But it doesn't look good in there. They had a garage.
And they've got washing machines in these remote villages and no electricity. Yeah.
You give them a taste of the good life and they want it all.
That's right.
It's going to be tough for communism to hold on to.
It's going to be tough. Yeah. It's going to be tough. And they have spent huge amounts of their resources on real estate projects and things like that. And as we all know, the real estate business does not move in a straight line.
Surprise. He's taking it home.
Now you know.
So after 38 years, I finally figured it out, John.
Now you tell me.
You haven't talked much, though, about the broader emerging market portfolio. Are you...
We like it.
Neutral in it, or...?
It's a little dicey right now because the emerging world trades primarily with Europe. And, you know, it's a chicken and egg thing. The emerging nations will resume their growth when Europe recovers. And, you know, that's anybody's guess about how that's gonna sort out. But ultimately, the emerging nations have the demographics that are required for strong growth. They're very young. They have practically no debt. And they have huge needs for infrastructure. And so you've got a formula for very rapid growth that will resume as soon as the global economy begins to emerge. And I think the story for the emerging world is completely intact over the longer term. They're going to grow at somewhere close to three times the rate of our economy. And so there will be a point where we will once again, with the expanding our exposure to the emerging sector, because I think that's where there's really going to be some strong growth.
Is there a way when you invest in energy to isolate that to energy in emerging markets?
Well, most, the vast majority of those companies are global companies.
Okay.
And they're going to go where the money is. But the exposure that we have is to the U.S., is to the energy sector of the S&P 500. That's the most widely traded, and it has the most liquidity. There are some other sectors that you could own. The problem that you run into there is that many of those companies are national companies, and it's hard to, you know, you get PetroChina, you get Pemex, you get companies, Lukoil, for instance, is a huge energy company, but it pretty much operates on the whim of Vladimir Putin. we have a sort of a bias toward U.S. companies that operate under U.S. accounting rules and U.S. laws, but have markets in those global sectors. They're gonna all get their share of it. I think the days of PetroChina doubling every 3 months are probably behind us. But that was a great ride while it lasted. So that's our view. It's going to be anybody's guess. We were up 8 when the market opened. The Speaker of the House popped off his mouth as we were coming in, and it sold off, and now we're back up 8. So somebody else must have said something.
Good. Your view on the back of the thing. Uh-huh. It's real interesting about the seemingly inevitable inflation that must follow an already massive injection of cash from a very stimulus and easing strategy. In either event, we may expect interest rates to climb rapidly, leaving hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars in lost market value in fixed income portfolios. Mm-hmm. That's going to be, that takes place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Typically.
I get it. My assistant always puts this in here. I mean, I guess I need to reread it before to remember what I said.
Well, I actually, I put
some
this
of this
out
gets written staff. Early in the morning.
I refer staff to this particular piece because it's concise and it draws all the rest of this stuff,
right,
which can leave you cross-eyed
or
completely not understanding what
I'm
it means.
A little surprised that Rick doesn't know what he writes, what he just said. But then I also found out he likes wine, so who knows when he writes this today.
This piece.
It's nice and concise.
Yeah, it's good.
When people ask me about the economy, I read off this and they, as if.
Well, you know
what I'm talking about. And then I say, no, I'm just reading what this professional gives me every quarter because I have no idea what's going on with the economy.
Well, this particular piece, I always try to have some sort of theme, and so it began with the lyrics from Prince's song about party like it's 1999. And I wrote it about the context that we were in 1999 and how expectations were, you know, the expectation was that the market was going to do 14 or 15% and earnings didn't matter. And I put a list here. The market peaked on March the 10th of 2000, if you recall that day. And on that particular day, I pulled off an article from CNNMoneyCom.com, and there was an article by an internet analyst who works, oddly enough, for a firm that no longer exists. And she gave her best ideas for the stock market for the coming 10 years. And if you look at the table there, only one of those stocks is trading higher than it did on the day that she said that they were slam dunks for the coming decade. And most of them no longer exist. She did happen to include Amazon in the list, and it did okay. But that was the context then, and it was like there was, you know, that earnings didn't matter, everything was going to go up forever, and we're in a different context now.
I found it fascinating when Facebook went public, that whole thing.
The expectations.
The expectations and
when expectations weren't fulfilled, people were trying to spin why they weren't fulfilled, and it's just interesting to listen to the folks who do this day in and day out, how they explain things,
you don't own
or how they fail to explain things.
You didn't own any Facebook in your portfolio.
It was interesting watching that stuff go on. So.
But that's how things go. There, and as you know, as I was saying earlier, there's a very strong behavioral component.
I know.
People typically pay attention to the last 30 minutes of information that they've received before they make stock market decisions.
Before they do
and
a model.
According to this, Amazon was the one to buy and the only one.
So if we could just kind of leave that out there about the bond portfolio for next quarter and let's see where we're going, and that might make sense for the portfolio.
Well, I can see on the energy portfolios because it does appear that more development is happening here in the States and in Canada. I don't know that they were actually having any less dependence on the Middle East.
We currently, beginning last September of a year ago, we became a net exporter of petroleum products.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, if we got cut off.
No, we still have significant imports,
but we
are a net exporter.
Yeah.
I think 2021 or something is.
We will become independent.
Yeah, we'll be independent.
Yeah.
With on the current path.
Are they going to wait that long to bomb each other?
And believe, and I will predict right now that someone in Washington will take credit for it.
Yeah, that's happened a lot.
You're going out on a limb, aren't you?
The gas prices go down, they'll take credit for that.
Gas prices will not go down. Yeah.
Al Gore invented the internet. Now, is Ron Paul, what did he invent that ran for vice president? Everybody, they glom onto those things, so somebody will take credit.
No, gas prices are not going to go down because energy is a commodity, and energy is priced. It's not priced proportionally. It's priced at the price of the last unit sold, which is the highest price unit.
And they're definitely not going down here in Lincoln County.
Well,
especially when you drive off to other parts of the state.
I was planning on filling up before I went back.
Well, compare. It's actually better than what it's been.
It's 40 cents a gallon below what it was 6 weeks ago.
And if you go to Florence, you might see a big price difference between.
Yeah,
it's place on the coast.
Well,
we keep hoping that Fred Meyer will open. Well, if Fred Meyer would open a gas station out here, then it's that competition. That's why it is in Florence.
I know.
Yeah.
Liz, do you have any proposed
No, I haven't. Other than the one person, I haven't heard any.
So that's the only one. Yeah.
I try and ask people to give me, you know, a heads up. I have someone that was talking this December, but after looking at the economy and health insurance is a big issue. Health insurance is a real big issue. He decided he was going to wait until he was 65 before he retired.
It's probably the fellow I talked to last week. I asked him when he was going to retire. He said that health insurance was.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
I get that a lot, you know. But
I think it was fiscal
year. I'm retiring in 6 years and 8 months.
Fiscal year, July.
Is that enough heads up?
You
won't be here.
I won't be here.
That's right. You won't go before I do.
I'm trying to get out of here in about 4 years. So.
Linda, Mike asked, when did the soft freeze for the defined benefit go into effect? Was it July 1st?
No, it was like March.
It was March. Yeah, it was earlier than that. Okay.
So this actuarial report really won't reflect much of a difference.
It won't.
Yet,
and unfortunately, I do not have the actuarial report. I'm very frustrated with our actuarials right now. They changed the person who did our report to someone else who is brand new and it's been one problem after another, and he's been sick and this has been going on, and then he finally got better and the person who checks his work is sick, and so I'm very frustrated.
Will we be able to get a copy of that one?
Yes, as soon as it does all electronically.
And the council will usually ask for one. I know there's a lot of more personal information in the back end, but usually but the front this, ten, yeah, the first was, 10 pages is the general.
I always just give them the first portion.
Right. And the council usually gets copies too, so make sure. I'll make sure.
Can you explain to Beverly that the new person always takes the rest of us to lunch on for her first meeting? Did you tell her that? Probably not.
We're lunch buddies. We spend a lot of time on the road together.
Yeah.
And
I
tend towards passenger food than Beverly does, so we've had to kind of scale back on my diet to accommodate her.
Yes. Well, great.
Thank you all for
meeting. Thank you.
Nice meeting you.
I got. I can thank you because I was on the cruise.
Yeah.